Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your well-being, the well-being of your community, and all that is going on in our multifaceted world, the health of our body politic, the health of our society, the health of our communities, and the ecological balance of planet Earth. On Connect the Dots each week, we talk about different facets of this with different thought leaders, authors, scientists, advocates, journalists, poets, filmmakers, all different kinds of people who have a different handle on the various facets of all that is going on in our complex world. On today's show, I'm really thrilled to have a returning guest, whose work I follow closely and have long admired, and we featured him on Connect the Dots several times as a result. And he's a journalist, a fellow journalist. He's actually a photojournalist in that he is multi-talented. He takes photographs, he films, and he writes. And his deep insights and courage, commitment to being on the front line at the cutting edge of, the most constructive advocacy efforts and issues of our time is what, to me, makes his work so notable. So I'm delighted to have him with us today. This is Michael Nigro, and he is reporting for diverse outlets over a number of different years, most recently for BuzzFeed and currently for Truthdig, where you can follow his work, which we'll be discussing on today's show, along with what he has been closely following most recently, which is the Poor People's March. Welcome back to Connect the Dots, Michael Nigro.
Thank you so much, Allison. You know, listening to the opening of this and just your show about the health of the nation, the health of the community, this is really what this Poor People's Campaign is about, the health of the community, the health of the planet. But I'm really happy to be back. This is my third time, so thanks for having me again.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have you here. Tell us a little bit about what's going on, because many people may not be familiar with what you're covering right now.
So the Poor People's Campaign is a continuation of Martin Luther King's Poor People's Campaign from 1968, which started, he kind of coupled that up with the Memphis sanitation workers' strike and was ramping up bring issues of systemic poverty and racism to the forefront, and he was going to have people go to the mall after his actions and occupy the mall. Now, unfortunately, he was assassinated, and this never came to fruition. So there's two co-chairs of the new Poor People's Campaign, a national call for a moral revival that is being driven and spearheaded by Reverend William Barber II and Reverend Liz Theo Harris. And they are the co-chairs, and they have been working on this for about 2 years now, going around and doing an audit of America with a number of different organizations of what is important, and going from state to state to state to state. And the whole audit of America that they have on their website is a fascinating read. They go by state of, the poverty, the racism, and just things that are going on in those communities. That being said, on May 14th, they started 40 Days of Actions, which in 38 states, including the District of Columbia, they were going to be going to the state capitol buildings and in each week staging nonviolent civil disobedience. The first week of actions, I was in Washington, D.C., where I would say about 700 people gathered. And again, there was 38 other state capitals that were doing the same thing and launching this campaign. And since then, I have been following the campaign, going to specific cities and to report on the campaign and to report on the issues that they're bringing to light. So I've been to Washington, D.C. I went to Illinois, where I was in Chicago in the morning, and then Springfield, the capital, in the afternoon. Then I went to North Carolina. And where else did I go?
North Carolina,
Lansing, Michigan, where members from Flint and Detroit came. And then just this past week, I was in Jefferson City, Missouri, where I ended up getting arrested along with 77 other people.
Wow. We'll talk about the arrest and freedom of the press and the ability of reporters to let people know what's going on. But let's just, talk a little bit about the motivation for this campaign, Reverend Barber, and, who's attracted to it and why this is becoming a vehicle for, the response to what's going on in the current administration and in our society.
Sure. You have Reverend William Barber, who is the architect of Moral Mondays, which started, I believe, in 2012 in North Carolina. Moral Mondays, they had a legislature that was all Republican, and they were stripping away voters' rights. They were stripping away the social safety net. So he and a number of advocates, clergy, and allies would go to the Capitol building, take it over, and have these moral sit-ins, these moral occupations, and they would be arrested every Monday. And this went on and on. So that was kind of the basis for William Barber to say, wait a minute, there's something larger here. It's not just North Carolina, it's America. And they are the real interesting part of this, and I know this always feels like it has a religious bent to it, and it does, but it is not just that. It is not left-right. It is not conservative, liberal, Democrat or Republican. It is a matter of right and wrong for them. And what is wrong is that they are looking at the moral compass needs to be corrected in this country. So you have
very fundamental.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they are adamant about calling out these political leaders who wrap themselves in the flag and hold these religious values, but they call them out. They call them heretics because there is no moral teaching in some of the things that are going on, and it is really powerful stuff. You do have not just left-leaning people involved in this. There is an evangelical minister from North Carolina named Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove. And he was conservative. He worked with Strom Thurmond, I believe, and has had this shift. And after hearing William Barber speak, and he is trying to bring in members of the right to this correcting of morality in America. And I've said this before, that you don't need to be wrapped in religious cloth to have morality. And I think we see that all the time, in that there are many people who say that they're these religious beings, but they're not. And then there are other people who don't call themselves religious at all, but they're completely moral beings. So I want to make that really clear to people who might be like, religion, let's just forget this. No, this is something bigger. It's just a matter of right and wrong. And just because the mouthpieces of William Barber and Liz Theo Harris, they happen to be religious leaders, they're all inclusive. They are all religious sects, from rabbis to Muslims to Christians to evangelicals to non-believers to agnostics are involved in this project. And week after week after week, it has been ramping up. And their saying is, this is built from the ground up, that it is not from the top down. It is from the ground up. And I've witnessed this because it's been a slow burn for the entire campaign. And a slow burn meaning, was this going to have momentum? Was this going to have legs? And when I first pitched this to a number of outlets I wanted to cover this, I had to explain what it was. It just wasn't getting that kind of coverage. And it really has not until recent weeks. I don't see national news sources covering this very much. It is getting bigger and better, but for the most part, it's local and independent media that is covering this.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So, you know, it's really, I mean, it's really interesting because I think it really strikes at the heart of the problem because we're in a moral dilemma. You know, there's posturing, there's, you know, inaccuracies, there's a long history of kind of presenting one thing and doing another, that the current, you know, kind of outrageous lie syndrome and the complete disregard for people, humanitarian, common human feeling, the public commons, all of that, you know, is being rooted out while there are these, you know, professions of religious belief, and it's just incredibly hypocritical, and I think it does present a moral dilemma, especially for people who really do carry those religious beliefs, but really for anyone of caring who carries any kind of caring values. So this is really kind of going to the heart of the matter. And I'm really fascinated, too, that it represents a kind of possibility of joining together and overcoming the divisions of the, you know, the two sides, so the so-called two sides, the duopoly, the two political parties, the, you know, the people who see themselves through the lens of these political parties as being adverse to each other. And yet what you're describing is that this is kind of stripping some of that constructed antagonism away and getting down to, you know, core values that are actually deeper than that, that most people share. That is an extraordinary new direction, and it would seem to have amazing potential. What do you see as potential of this movement, you know, prospectively, because we don't have a crystal ball here, obviously.
Sure. When you have a group like this that, again, has been slowly gaining momentum, and you realize that that the facts are on their side, the true facts that there are 140 million Americans living on or below the poverty line in the richest nation in human history. That it does not have to be this way. And when you position this as a matter of right and wrong, that is why you see different people from different social stratas and religions coming together listening. And when I said the facts are on their side, they have done their homework so well, and they are able to speak so eloquently on this. And you can read it on thepoorpeoplescampaign.org, what they have put together. And I don't want to say that, you know, and the reason why I am covering this is that, yeah, these are the facts, but people are not they're not data. There needs to be a face to these stories. There needs to be a face to the woman who lost two children because she drank Flint water. There needs to be a face to the people in Kansas City with the Fight for 15 who won 75% of the vote to get that $15 per hour, but then the Chamber of Commerce of Missouri took it away from them, which is not democratic at all. You need to see these faces and hear these stories. And the tough part is you know, I don't know how many of these people survive. 140 million Americans, these children, these kids, these people working two, three jobs for wages, for communities that have been poisoned, literally poisoned in Flint. Their water is being shut off. They don't have access to health care. And to bring these people out of the shadows and trying to survive – I'll tell a little story that I did a show for Netflix a few years back. It was a pilot for them about the homelessness crisis happening in Seattle, which is now even bigger than when I did it 2 or 3 years ago. And walking into these homeless encampments underneath Highway 5, and they have tent cities there. They almost have there's refugee camps in the middle of this city. And I would walk in to some of the places that were really dangerous. They used to call it, I can't remember what it was called underneath the bridge there, but it was a dangerous place. And you were walking into places where people had nothing to lose. And I'm walking in there with these big cameras and stuff, and I'm like, this is a big mistake. Because when you have nothing to lose, then there's a dangerous aspect to this. I'm getting the feeling when I'm walking around with these people who are just hanging on that there are aspects of this where they have nothing to lose, and I think this is why this is growing and growing and growing. With Anthony Bourdain, I know this is going to sound bizarre, but when he committed suicide, and across social media, people were writing, reach out, ask for help. And I'm not belittling him. I think he was a great human being. I think the work he did, but I could not couple it together with what I've been witnessing with the Poor People's Campaign. There are 140 million people out there right now asking for help. They're literally asking for help. And we have to take a celebrity to make ourselves feel better, to post on social media, ask for help, ask for help. Like, there are people out there. They are your neighbors. They are in your communities, asking for help. So I know I've had a hard time not zippering it together, Poor People's Campaign and Anthony Bourdain's death and the people's response to it. And maybe it's a disconnect, but I really have not been able to separate the two. It really was an emotional thing for me, having been in the field talking to these people.
Yes, there's an irony, and I share your sense of that, because it's kind of like, and actually I did a post about this on Facebook, a brief post, which some people, you know, felt hit the nail, and other people were really offended by, but because basically it takes a white person, a successful, famous white person to sort of go out into the community, and then we look at the person. Isn't he a wonderful person for caring for these people? Has it led us further to care for those people, right? And so, everyone is kind of feels poignant, in regards to the loss of a wonderful human being, a deeply caring person. But, what people will often say is, I've heard this too. I want to go out and, experience all things in life. They don't say, I want to go and help directly or listen to the people directly who are hurting. And, as obvious as they may be, either because of the mainstream media, lack of coverage, it's like people don't really – they know to look at him because they're sitting there watching him on TV, but they don't know where to look, or they don't choose to go out and find out where to look to help the actual people who are hurt and damaged by these policies. It's not that everyone doesn't do this, but it's kind of like, in a way it helps us. It's like it helps us by pointing to the people, but we get caught up with a celebrity, and that's the difference between, I think, some have called him a journalist. And I think the fact that he included his subjective responses so honestly, so painfully honestly, even when it was kind of politically incorrect to do it, I really salute him for that. But the difference between that and, people like yourself who are real journalists is that time after time after time, they go out into dangerous situations, as you're describing, but the focus is not on you, on yourself. It's really on the people and giving a voice and telling the story of the people whom otherwise people don't see. You know, the mainstream culture kind of looks away from and has taught us to look away from.
You know,
are we paying enough attention to the People's Campaign as opposed to Anthony Bourdain?
Great question, because you have corporate media, which we've discussed before on this show, and I'm sure your listeners have their own feelings about it. You know, they report on corporate news, and it is not until this will gain a groundswell. I mean, look, you can go to Standing Rock, you can go to Flint, Michigan. It took 18 months before the mainstream media started really reporting on it. And it was because of Kurt Guyette, who just doggedly kept reporting on it, independent news source. Standing Rock was the same way. And we've discussed Standing Rock as well. But with the Poor People's Campaign, yes, they want eyeballs on this. Yes, they want people to start to report on it. But if the strength of a social movement is measured by the proportion of force inflicted by those in power that are trying to kill it, I would say now, in this coming up in the sixth week of the Poor People's Campaign, that it's really garnered enough momentum that the campaign is going to start get more and more coverage. And the reason why I say this is because what happened last week, as opposed to the weeks leading up to that, the first few weeks, people couldn't even get arrested. These were acts of civil disobedience, sitting down inside state capitol buildings, blocking the roads, blocking entrances. In Boston, they blocked the entrance and roads for hours. The police would not arrest them. In Kentucky, they took over the state capitol building and slept overnight. They let them. Pizzas were brought in. They don't want this to succeed. They don't want people to get behind it. They don't want it to become get the momentum of an Occupy Wall Street, where at first, you know, it's that whole Gandhi. Well, I guess it's attributed to Gandhi, which is first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. I think the Poor People's Campaign has gone through the ignore. And then they're laughing, because then I went to Chicago and I was in Springfield, Illinois, and they took over the state capitol building. They chanted for hours. They lost their voice. The cops kind of laughed at them. They gave them gum and water, and they wouldn't arrest them. But now they're in the fight phase. Things have absolutely changed over these few weeks. You have just 2 weeks ago, Kentucky, who let them sleep overnight. They blocked the state, blocked people from entering the state, the Capitol building. And they would only let two activists in at a time. And if two left, two more could go in. Now, that is the Capitol is the preeminent place to assemble and seek redress from a government. And that's guaranteed by right. That is where you do it. And they blocked them. And then they blocked them from the Arkansas State House, and they blocked in the New Jersey State House, and in New York they gave the campaign a bill for rally security, and then in Kansas they were informed they weren't allowed in because they harmed the building. Now in where I was just last week. Or last Monday was Jefferson City, Missouri. And Jefferson City is a city of about 43,000 people. It's smack in the middle of the state. To the east, you have St. Louis, about 2 hours away. To the west, you have Kansas City. And there in Jefferson City, there were about 77 arrests. And I was one of the few journalists there. There were other journalists there, but the way I normally work, and I've been doing this for a couple years now, is as a photojournalist, I've been putting my phone on top of my camera and live streaming. And this is for protection. It started out as first, that people seemed to like what I was doing, and so I would get commentary as well. And so whatever I'm shooting, you see live stream, and then you're able almost to like match up the pictures that I took from that live stream when the pictures are filed and published.
Mm-hmm.
I was covering it in the way I always do, and these are peaceful protests. I've been behind the scenes during the training of these actions in a number of cities. They sign all members of the Poor People's Campaign. If you're going to be part of an act of civil disobedience, you sign a covenant of nonviolence. And this is based on King and his teachings. And this has been carried through this Poor People's Campaign. And they have every right to protest, every right to protest. And I have every right to cover it. And as we have seen in recent years, they are really stifling any sort of coverage and journalism. And this was the first time where I was told to leave this area. And again, like, I was not pushing it. I know when to push it. I know when I want to push it. This was just soft. It was loud, but and powerful. But I'm just covering it. I am just shooting. And throughout the entire day, even 30 seconds into my live stream, I just stepped off the curb. It hasn't even started yet. And this three cops from the side got on the bullhorn. And they gave me a final warning. They just said, "That's it, final warning." And I'm like, "What? I'm like, this is crazy." And I heard,
"What does
final
that
warning,
even mean?"
They would arrest me if I did something else. And I thought that was ridiculous and ludicrous, and nothing was happening. Again, this is kind of this George Bailey, It's a Wonderful Life type of city. There's very few cars. That to me was a signal. I said, these guys, they're going to make an arrest very quickly. It may or may not be a journalist, because I've seen this tactic before, to arrest someone really quickly to make people fearful and to step back and to not cover. So I was right. About 7 minutes in, they arrested two people who were not performing an act of civil disobedience. They weren't armband. Anybody who's going to engage in civil disobedience, they have a signal and armband with it. They were not. These two women were just shocked that they were arrested. And I'm like, well, okay, there are those arrests. And then I kept hearing to other people, final warning, just, you know. So when it happened to me again, the guy said, get on the sidewalk, sign up, final warning. I always move back. If they tell me to move, I will move. And so I moved, and I looped around, and this is all live stream. And I'm trying to find space. I'm walking past people in the street still. And another police officer yells at me, final warning, and I'm like, okay. So I start coming back to where I originally was, getting on the sidewalk, and the original cop grabs me and arrests me. And to which I said, you know, I'm just doing my job. And he said something to the effect of, you can do your job in handcuffs or something like that.
Well,
which... that was kind of this, that they did not want, they don't want this covered, and they don't want this to gain momentum. But again, like I said before, social movements, they have a symbiotic relationship with how much force is put on them. The more momentum they get, the stronger the force is going to be. We saw it at Occupy, we saw it at Standing Rock. It's just kind of this tandem that moves. Now the question is, can the Poor People's Campaign, along with the thousands of activists across the country, continue to gain momentum? Can it ripple outward into these sacrifice zones, as Chris Hedges also often calls them, these communities of poverty? Can it get these 140 million people to say, wow, we deserve better. We deserve health care. We deserve clean water. We deserve not to be poisoned. We deserve not to have our kids die without medical attention because they don't have Medicaid and health care. So that's the real question. And next week is going to be really interesting because it everything comes together in Washington, D.C., from across the country. This is where the big gathering is going to be. And I do want to say something else that happened last week, which was in D.C., where clergy members, including Reverend Lucio Harris, went to the steps of the Supreme Court and began to pray. And they were immediately arrested. And they ended up being taken off to jail, shackles on their feet and on their hands, their religious vestments taken off of them. They spent 27 hours in jail. They had to have their passports given up, and which is a problem because Reverend Theo Harris is supposed to be speaking in Geneva on the Poor People's Campaign in a couple of weeks' time. This is a complete crackdown on this movement, and it just shows that you do have the power elite and the lawmakers taking notice. And if they take notice, because it's going to affect capital money and corporate dollars, you will start to see the mainstream media covering it. Whether they cover it correctly, whether they get on the street, whether they stand back like they did at Standing Rock and pretend that they're reporting, that remains to be seen.
That's rather intense because, you know, here on the one hand, we have this hypocritical respect for religion. And then, you know, here's a situation where a religious leader who's respected internationally, which certainly the current administration is not, has a bureaucratic knot where he could potentially be precluded from going abroad and kind of kept a prisoner within this country. I mean, not literally in jail, perhaps, but, without the freedom of access. And it's such a stark contrast with the recent G7 meeting where, you know, Trump has a way of kind of not attending meetings as a, you know, as part of his job to participate and talk with global leaders, but more, you know, as like somebody who comes into Studio 54 and then decides to leave. Huh?
This is not William Barber. This is the other co-chair, Liz Theo Harris, who had her passport
Liz.
Taken away. Just, but
right.
So you're speaking the same. The content is the same. Denied, and she should have freedom to move about.
Right. I mean, it's just, you know, the president attends a global conference as if it's a cocktail party, that he has another engagement, that conflicts with it. And, you know, he's going to breeze in and out. And then other people are severely and wrongfully conscripted. You know, when you – just stepping back to when you reported on, your own arrest, were these police in any way aware, that there is such a thing as freedom of the press? Why was – what you're doing illegal from any point of view, theirs, yours, or, was it?
Yeah, I don't think they care. This one particular officer was actually the officer who arrested the two women I discussed earlier on. He came in after the first one was arrested and then arrested her friend right away. My charge was on the ticket, actually just says fail to obey. When I asked in the fail to obey, and then which essentially he said move, and I did. Then to get on the sidewalk, which I was moving toward when they grabbed me. Verbally in the jail, I asked. I said, "What is the charge?" And he said, "Failure to obey orders," which. I wanted to chuckle at the time, but that's what everybody received. I was the only one of this group, and this is the real interesting part. For the people who were sitting down in the street outside the Missouri Chamber of Commerce, they negotiated with the police right there that it was going to be catch and release. Catch and release means you ask them, you're going to be arrested, you pick them up, you walk them over to a precinct, to a car, You hand them your license, you get your, you get a picture taken, you get a summons, and then you're free to go home. I, however, was handcuffed in the truck, watching through the diamond mesh, steel mesh, watching all the protesters that are getting arrested get their summons, and then they're free to go. I was, you know, eventually taken after about an hour in the car. I was eventually taken to and I was processed and fingerprinted and eye scanned and asked a whole battery of questions, and then eventually released. So that was actually rather interesting for me to witness, like, all the protesters being just caught and released.
So that's designed to act as a kind of deterrent. Can you tell our listeners the dates that in Washington, D.C., in the third week of June, that the Poor People's Campaign will be gathering? In case anyone might be interested.
It's going to there's a kickoff for all different states. And I know that in these 38 states where there have been actions, there are buses and people that are leaving on Monday. So if you're in Oregon, if you're in Ohio, if you're in Arkansas, and if you're in Mississippi, you're getting on a bus and you're traveling to D.C. to get there by Tuesday the 19th. And then from the 19th all the way to the 23rd, there will be actions and teachings, and they're going to be one of the main thrusts of this is voter registration and teaching people how to go door to door and knock on the door, and having this ripple effect across the country of people learning and knowing how to get people to sign up to vote. This 40 days of action is not the end of the Poor People's Campaign, as all their literature says. It's the beginning. They are not going to stop. I imagine there will be more actions to come after this 40 days is over. And they're looking at this as almost like a two-year project to continue to show their discontent that they deserve better. On the 23rd, which is Saturday, that is the big rally on the Mall in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's so interesting. I can't, you know, it's funny, like, this is now the second time during this conversation. And, of course, this is how journalists think. You know, they don't just think about, you know, a single isolated instance, no matter how broad or whatever. They see it in connection with all the other things that are going around at the time, you know, that are part of the current activity and zeitgeist. You know, I can't help but think when I hear that a key part of this is voter registration, of the fact that, you know, recently there was a meeting in Hollywood where, you know, Hollywood marketing people and, you know, people who know how to spend a lot of money getting a message across are actually planning to do model voter registration campaigns. In other words, like, let's get some actors and show them registering to vote, you know, to get more people voting, as, you know, that's perceived rightly as, you know, a problem. But, you know, it's as if people, you know, need to be reminded rather than that the candidates need to be speaking for them in some kind of way. But in any case, you know, so here are two different groups getting people, you know, urging people, wanting people, more people to register to vote. And one is, you know, going around the country and gathering people state by state and city by city and building this momentum organically from the grassroots up, as you said at the very beginning of the show. And the other group is, you know, planning to spend a lot of money making slick ads, you know, to get some other part of the population to vote. So, and this is like the, you know, on behalf of the Democratic National Committee. I mean, what a studying contrast. If it would seem that if, you know, it would seem that if you walked your talk, you know, instead of spending money on these ads, this money could go to help support, because I'm sure it's in, you know, these people are, you know, as you describe, in desperate states, you know, an incipient movement of people who want to vote and want to get their friends and relatives to vote, you know, rather than kind of inducing people who don't feel vested in it in some kind of way. I mean, it's just such a startling contrast to me that the two things happen concurrently.
Right. I mean, it's many people are writing about this, and it's the problem with the Democratic Party, that people are, you know, just party people. Because that sounded odd. They're party people. No, but it's that two-party system and that tribalism between the two, where I think this having this third party, heck, call it the moral party, because that could be this collective 140 million people plus their advocates and allies trying to show that people deserve better, that they can have health care, that it doesn't have to be. I mean, look, these people Ben Carson is saying he's going to raise the rent on 20% on these people. How is that possible? It's just insane. And if people don't start fighting back with this, and I think it's only going to get worse with the poor, and you know, you can only go so far down. But that's what I was talking about before, which is when people have nothing to lose. That's when I think the rubber can hit the road, and with more allies, whether it's a Hollywood actor or somebody like a Tom Steyer, who's also spending $30 million to get people to register to vote, and they're looking for young people to vote. They're going around to college campuses. Tom Steyer is the hedge fund billionaire who's been taking out ads on CNN, trying to get Donald Trump impeached. But, you know, the work that he is doing is also voter registration with young people, because young people, if they vote once, they're more apt to vote again. But you also have the Supreme Court, and this is what the clergy were protesting in front of the Supreme Court when they were all arrested, which was they upheld the voter registration, that they were just going to eradicate, that it was legal to eradicate the voters who haven't voted, and which is voter suppression, and we know that it has an effect.
So interesting. You know, they want young people to vote. Be careful what you wish for. Of course, you know, the people who are getting pressed, you know, getting ground down or rising up is, you know, they don't actually need advertising to inform them, you know, slick advertising to inform them of that fact. Obviously, it's really for the people on the sidelines. You know, who want to feel good about themselves and feel their help being helpful, and, you know, and maybe in some ways are being helpful or could be helpful. That's, you know, that, I mean, there's so many ironies in all of this. It's just really amazing. You know, was that your first arrest? And, you know, what is it like to be arrested, actually?
It was not my first arrest. I was... Once I was handcuffed during Occupy Wall Street, not handcuffed, I was flexi-tied, and it was one of those instances where they took a number of people and kind of threw us in the street and then arrested us for blocking traffic. I was with a number of journalists, and they ended up letting us go, which does not happen. So normally when you are arrested, there is no talking your way out of it for some reason. I think because there was a journalist there that they knew. They ended up just arresting – they ended up letting these people go, but they had arrested a number of other people. Then in 2016 at a Trump rally – at a Trump protest in New York City, the same thing had happened to me where I was covering it. The police blocked off all the streets. They had everyone get out of the street. I ran ahead and was taking photographs, went to the sidewalk. I again was pulled onto the sidewalk, thrown into the street, and had four or five different cops on me. It's very odd being arrested in New York City as opposed to being arrested in Missouri. It's very different. But the five cops on me were just like kind of pulling me in all different directions and all screaming, stop resisting, stop resisting. But I know that I just calmly say, not resisting, not resisting. And it's a bit surreal. And I will tell you that the powerlessness of it, of feeling this. And again, I in Missouri, I was there for 4 hours, but to be in a wagon and handcuffed, and then in a concrete cell where nothing is, and you've seen these videos where these guys come in and they beat you up or whatever. It's those thoughts run through your mind. You know, at one point when I was in the paddy wagon, I have my handcuffs on, and the van starts to move. And I said, "Hey, I'm not strapped in here." And the officer says, "Oh, I'm just moving back. I'm just moving back." Of course, I'm referring to Freddie Gray. But those are the things. You are powerless to do anything. You are utterly powerless. And it's you just remain calm. You don't say a whole lot. Some of the officers try to have conversations with you. As one officer, when I was being released and I finally had the waist cuffs taken off me and they gave me my gear back, he said, "I do have a question for you." And I said, he said, "Will you answer it?" And I said, "Depends what it is." He said, "I want to go to New York City. What shouldn't I miss?" And I'm like, "Are you serious? Are you dead serious?" And I just kind of laughed, and I just told him a couple of things, and then I left. So
God.
It's
the moment of humanity, but it's also the moment of dissociation. You know.
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't an arresting officer. He was just working back there. They were kind of having fun with my last name, as to how to pronounce it. And it's
right.
Nigro, and of course I've always been, whatever, ridiculed and everything like that. And but they were just like, "I told you it was Nigro," and they're all laughing at me. another odd thing about being arrested in Missouri was the battery of questions that I got, which was, "What's your religious preference? Do you have any dietary restrictions?" And being eye scanned, and then your fingerprints and things like that, it's just kind of like, well, I am powerless. I am 100% powerless here. And I will tell you, I really felt that I was being arrested for committing an act of journalism that day. And I will be out again next week committing more acts of journalism. It is essential to be out there, to be able to shoot this, to be able to, and at the same token, this is protection for me, the protesters, and the police. People need to see this. People need to see what is going on. I don't like becoming part of the story. It's not why I do what I do, but it often happens that I have been. You know, in Charlottesville, the same thing happened to me, where I became a part of the story, where people wanted to talk to me about, you know, being clipped by the car that drove by. Standing Rock was the same thing. But I wrestle with it a bit, but there are moments where I said, is this important to say? Is it important to talk about my experience? And the fact of the matter is, in a number of instances, yeah, it really is. People need to know what journalists go through, what people trying to report, whether it's citizen journalists, whether it's independent media, they need to see that it's hard, sometimes thankless work, but when you get enmeshed with the story, I think it can shine more light on it and shine more light on the Poor People's Campaign. And frankly, if this actually shows, as it did with Occupy, where they were suppressing the press, where they were putting the press away and putting them in, you know, freedom cages, and you can only shoot from here, or just like not letting cameras in at all, as when they raided the camp. That's a big problem, and people need to hear from the press that it's wrong. That is 100% wrong. It's not the First Amendment. It's a violation of the First Amendment, and the press has the right to keep people accountable, period.
I think a lot of people don't really understand the role of the media. They don't understand whistleblowers. In all cases, you know, they, because of the, you know, the mainstream media television shows, which is where many people get news, it's like personalities, they're, you know, well made up, the lights upon them, they're celebrities, you know. And, of course, there's some angle on the news or some coverage that happens there, but the sense of it's being, a, you know, whether or not that's a complete picture isn't really clear, I think, to many people. I was at a film screening of a film called Dark Money, and actually hoping at some point to get the director, Kimberly Reed, on the show. It's about the infusion of corporate cash into politics and how the state of Montana resisted that, and it also shows the way, you know, funded conservative right-wing kind of groups come in to impinge on the election process. In a variety of ways, including, you know, of course, the direct donations and everything. This whole story came to light because there was a whistleblower. Somebody within an organization got the information and gave it to the Center for Media and Democracy. And yet, you know, the fact that the state of Montana prevailed in keeping their state free of corporate cash and influence really was due to there being a media outfit like the Center for Media and Democracy, and there being journalists there, and there being a whistleblower, someone on the other side, as you describe, you know, some of these people of religious faith who are finding the current dissent in moral values intolerable, you know, kind of changing their view and coming in and joining forces, you know, across these purported lines of division. You know, so that's what happened, and that's why that state is still free. And yet I can tell you that the whole audience, when, you know, they knew to support a film, like, you know, hey, we're good viewers of NPR or PBS, and we know to donate to PBS or something, but they didn't know to support the real journalism that's behind this film. They didn't have a clue about the fact that the transformation happened thanks to a whistleblower. I think people are, you know, many, many people have been so conditioned by the mainstream, it's not only they miss the kinds of important stories that you're covering, but they don't even understand why they should be covered. And I would bet there are people listening to us right now who are kind of like, well, my God, if arrests are happening, how come you didn't stay home and protect yourself? Rather than, I'm sure there are people, you know, you knew that they would be da-da-da-da. Why did you do this? You know, so that's a bit of a provocative challenge. Can you let people know a little, you know, further, what moves you and why what you are doing and what other true journalists do is so important?
Why do I do what I do? I don't know what drives me to go into these situations, except that I this sense of injustice. And it really happened for me during Occupy, where I was there just filming. I was filming a lot and listening to stories. And not I'll bring it back full circle with Anthony Bourdain, who said, I think he was talking about the Palestinians, was a quote that was kind of going around, is that, you know, these people aren't statistics. They're people. And that is not what I was getting from the news. I was getting statistics, and I was getting data. I was not getting full story. I was not, it was just too theoretical. But to be there and to see this kind of suffering, to see these people hurting and calling out from the fringes and being ignored, is, it's unacceptable to me. And it should be unacceptable to other people who witness these types of things. So when I go in and I take a photograph and I want to share it, I want to put it out there, and I will file it, I want people to see it
And I want them to know that this is happening. And if you don't stand up and do something about it, you're complicit in this suffering too. And that's not an original thought of mine. It's something that I've been listening to other photojournalists talk about, but I believe it is true that we are all on this planet. And there is a social, unwritten social contract that an activist, Adi Barkin, has been talking about, that we have to stay with each other and be with each other and support each other. And what is happening now is that there are, again, 140 million Americans that are just statistics to many people. I need to show that suffering. I need people to see those faces, hear those stories, and listen to what we're doing to our fellow man. And what we're doing is we've lost the threat of democracy. When you have a democratic system that is no longer democratic, that they're shutting down voting rights, they're shutting down health care, they're shutting down a $15 minimum wage when 75% of a state votes for it, that's a huge problem. So that is why I guess I do what I do. And I will continue to do it. And I guess that if being a journalist on the street is now a act of civil disobedience, I guess I have to, you know, figure out, you know, how far do I push it every week? How far do I go? And that's what I truly felt when in Missouri. Like I'm like, I'm not performing an act of civil disobedience here. I am reporting. Unfortunately, they saw it a different way, and they stopped me from doing what I do.
We've been speaking to Michael Nigro, a premier, courageous, and committed journalist, photojournalist, and filmmaker. Michael is now reporting on Truthdig. Please follow his stories there. You can see the footage that we've been discussing throughout this program, as well as follow the events that will be occurring this week in Washington, D.C. And if you can, please consider attending and going down there to yourself participate and stand on the line with the Poor People's Campaign that we've covered in this edition of Connect the Dots. Thank you so much, Michael, for once again bringing the front lines home to so many people, to our awareness. And, you know, may good fortune and gratitude follow you in your commitment and your work and your dedication and in all that you do. You know, just deeply touched.
I appreciate that. Thanks, Rose. Thank you.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us today in this wonderful conversation with Michael Nigro on Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy.